Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media and WBFO, this is What's Next, producer picks of the week. Highlights of the best What's Next episodes heard during the previous week. On today's show, we'll hear segments from all three episodes that aired this week, starting with...
And post-COVID, we've seen, you know, just way more people seeking care. I think part of that is there was a lot more talk about depression, anxiety, people struggling, you know, more outreach programs and more people saying that it's okay to do that. So...
Monday's episode with Cindy Volker, the CEO of Spectrum Health. We'll then move to...
Gordon Ramsay was the number one important thing, what he said to me and taught me and mentored me. He said, Bobby, you can participate in the real American dream. And no one never told me that. I had a great father. He never told me that. And I went on this journey to understand what that meant.
Tuesday's episode with celebrity chef Bobby Anderson. And we'll close with...
Much can be talked about this house, and we can spread the word about the architecture and the significance of the building, but at the same time, to turn it into a community space. So inviting the public in, having exhibitions, lectures, workshops, making this place used.
Wednesday's episode with Albert Chow, an architect involved with the Coles House project. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for tuning in. First, we revisit Jay Moran's conversation with Cindy Volker, the CEO of Spectrum Health. The two discussed the growing need for more mental health services and the challenges of staffing, as well as a $200,000 grant awarded to Spectrum Health.
But recently, the Patrick Lee Foundation awarded you guys a $200,000 grant. This is interesting because of what that money is needed for. You, very much like here at Buffalo Toronto Public Media, sustained some fairly significant damage during that Christmas blizzard of 2022, which sounds a long time ago, but for you, I know, and your crew, feels very much a recent endeavor. What exactly happened over at your Main Street location?
Well, so the best that we can figure is on that Friday night of the 22nd when the storm started, the wind blew a window out on the top floor. It's at 1280 Main Street, so it's right next to the Delta Sonic down on Main Street in Main and Bryant. And it froze the sprinkler system on the top floor of the building, which is the third floor of a 40,000 square foot building. And the sprinklers broke in two spots, so the water started pouring out of there. And we really didn't get a notification to our operations guy, who had no power for 2 days, until Sunday, that there was something going on at the building. Of course, there was really, I mean, there were so many other tragic things going on. You're not going to get, you know, the police or the fire company to come to your building, right? So, I mean, it is an interesting story because my husband and I, who happen to live about, you know, right near Snyder area, got into my husband's 4Runner and we drove down Main Street and went to the building, and the water was pouring out of the building.
Oh, literally coming out of the building.
Literally pouring out of the building, out of the windows. And, so, you know, we actually went into the building, into the basement, and followed the directions of our operations guy, got into the maintenance room, and then were able to get the what we needed to turn the water wheel of the water into the building.
Oh, my.
And it was just pouring down the whole thing. So I knew at that point it was really bad, you know, but in a lot of ways I was like, well, no one's, you know, dead. It's not, it's a building, we'll fix it, right? You know, so, but so we were able to get the water off, which the only fortunate thing is it saved the heating system that we had, which was an antiquated system down in the basement, which it stopped just level of running it not go out. And then it also, we were able to save the server room, which was down there as well for all of our servers, because we had built that kind of, you know, in a way that was more protected. So that was the beginning of how it all happened. And
the road back has been long, and it continues as we speak here, almost two plus years afterwards. Yeah. So what was the damage estimate finally on the building?
$15 million to replace everything because, you know, it had to have all new windows. You know, first of all, it had to be all brought up to code To get approvals, you know, going forward. It was an old building. It's over 100 years old. It's been many different things over the years. And we, you know, had put some money into it over time. But, you know, replacing a whole building of windows is, difficult for a not-for-profit agency. But so it needed a lot of those things. And just the entire thing had to be gutted. We had a, you know, just the first year was really just getting it to the point where we could rebuild. So there was obviously an under, you know, under insurance, which resulted from a lot of things, you know, costs just going up for everything, and just has gone up continuously as we're working on it, right? And also, you know, just that, you know, the code piece and all those things that we just didn't anticipate you would have to replace everything at one time, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
Lessons learned.
Right. You know. How many people work in that building, or worked in that building?
Yeah, we had over 125 employees. We had, you know, about 6 different programs that we have that were out of there. So those staff had to be deployed to different places 2 years later now.
So. Wow. So let's take a step then before we start talking about the specific services in that building. Let's just talk about Spectrum overall, because it's a, as we were talking before we were on the air, Spectrum's been around for about 50 years right now. It's a name that we kind of all know about. I'm sure every once in a while you get confused with the local or the national cable company, which I'm sure.
That's why we went with Spectrum Health and Human Services.
Spectrum Health and Human Services. But what are the services that, are provided by Spectrum?
Well, Spectrum is a not-for-profit community behavioral health center located across 7 different counties in Western New York. And we do, I'd say half of our business is doing certified community behavioral health center clinics. So we do integrated mental health, behavioral health with addiction issues and helping people recover from serious illness all the way from people with depression, anxiety. We also work with kids and families. We're in some of the schools. We're in pediatricians' offices, doctors' offices. So we do a lot of just basic mental health and addiction work across those regions. And then we specialize in a lot of community-based programs. So we do ACT teams, assertive community treatment teams that go out into the community and take a doctor, a nurse, and other staff. We do that in Niagara County, Erie County, and Cattaraugus County. We have care coordinators that are like case managers that help link people to services. We do reentry for people coming out of prison and out of the forensic system under the Office of Mental Health. And we work with parole and probation to help people, you know, make it successfully back into the community and help them with those things. We have a large supportive housing program where we support people in individual apartments within the community. So that's that and provide case management and support so people can, you know, homeless individuals who finally get their, you know, back into being able to be housed. So we do a lot of services that, you know, meet community needs for a lot of people that have a lot of serious issues and you know, need a lot of support in the community.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like all the different services you're talking about, whether it's helping out people who had been previously homeless, people who have suffered from addiction, mental health issues as well, all on the rise? All that demand? Is that demand on the rise?
All on the rise.
Yeah?
Yes.
What can you tell me about that? What do we understand? We've touched on the subject frequently on this program, so I most certainly am familiar with that. But at the same time, I'd like to hear your take on, you know, why this is happening and just how prevalent it is.
So if there's quite a few things I think that happened. I mean, there has been obviously since the COVID, during COVID and post-COVID, we've seen, you know, just way more people seeking care. I think part of that is there was a lot more talk about depression, anxiety, people struggling, you know, more outreach programs and more people saying that it's okay to do that. So a little bit of the stigma, I think, has gone away in terms of it's okay to get help and you should get help. And so
that's a positive.
More
positive
people
problem.
Are asking for help, right?
Yeah.
So that helps. I think also that for people who have more serious issues, you know, there's less hospital space for people. There's less places for people to go that need a higher level of care where they need more protected environment. There's very, you know, the system is move towards a community base, which works for a lot of people, but for some people it's more challenging. So you've expanded a lot of those programs, so a lot of your staff now are spread between a lot of programs, you know, and the state's been working to, you know, fund programs. I mean, New York has a lot of services compared to a lot
Absolutely.
Of states.
Right.
We really are very fortunate. But I think so there's that piece of it. And then you know, the homelessness, you know, that obviously it's very challenging, even when you have some resources, to get people reasonable, you know, accommodations that they can afford with support from our programs, because of the cost of rents have gone up. Yep. And, you know, people's difficulties maintaining their cost of living, which then leads to homelessness or stress about that, that leads to addiction issues being exacerbated, leads to mental health. So I think that, and then just one other thing is that probably the most concerning is we've seen a big increase in youth having mental health issues, and maybe even more so than addiction issues, like mental health and serious, like suicide attempts. It's really been, I think all of us that do those services are like, wow, we have, that is a problem we have to keep working at.
And when we're talking youth, it could be any
age.
Oh,
you're talking from, you know, age of six, wow, you know, 7 years old into the teens, where there's that is the biggest increase of suicide attempts and some completed in our business in the last few years. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about what contributes to that, you know, how do we get to that? But there is a lot of services and things going on now and trying to address those issues. So all in all, the other part of it is we all have less staff. Mm-hmm. And there has been not enough workforce to keep up with the demand. So that's something we've all, you know, been, you know, challenged to figure out ways to work with.
And well, so, yeah, maybe let's talk about that then. How, you know, from your perspective now, you know, you moved through this organization over four decades at a variety of levels. Yeah. Now you're at the top looking over it, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So how have you and your organization, have you adjusted to this increased need?
Mm-hmm. So we have, you know, we have looked at how to provide the services where people need them. So going more into integrating into, you know, schools, into the community, putting smaller clinics in different places where people could easily access what you're doing. And then also there's the virtual piece of it that we all still do a little bit of that helps people more in rural areas or they can't get out of their home and things like that. The workforce issue, there's been a big movement to also certify and train individuals that we call peers, so people who have had experiences themselves with mental health or addiction. And then in New York State, you can get certification under both of those, and you can get a job with any of our agencies. Most of us have those types of jobs, but we've built a lot into a department that supports that. So that brings a whole other piece of it, but it gives you another workforce to support people. Clinical clinicians and, you know, master's social workers, licensed mental health counselors, we do a lot of us, you know, what we've done is we develop very good intern programs for internships. We, you know, try to be, you know, family friendly, flexible, all the things you hear. But we do, I think right now it's really focusing on training and interns and, you know, being a place where people want to come to. And we work with a lot of schools across the region to do that. So there's been a lot of concerted efforts on many fronts to try to keep the workforce and train them.
I'm interested about the intern program in the sense that are we also seeing maybe individuals, younger people who have a sensitivity to what the types of issues we've already talked about, mental health issues, and are maybe finding their way into this field?
Yes. I mean, many times people find their way into the field for that very reason. They've experienced that, or someone in their family has, and they really want to help people. I mean, the people that work for all of us, they want to help people. That's why they're there, right? You're not going to, you know, you're not going to be getting rich. You know, I mean, it's you have to be very dedicated to wanting to help people, which is what we do. But yes, I think you do see a lot of people that kind of find their way because of the experiences. And as I say, a lot of times it's very hard not to find a family or a person that you talk to that you could say, do you not know someone who has had addiction or mental health issues?
Right.
You know, that's very rare, you know, that you don't know that. So that is a plus, but it can also be stressful for people when they get into the field as well, because there's a lot to deal with. So you have to provide a lot of support for that.
I'm just going to just get into that. Yeah. What about the support? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you go about maybe assessing that and trying to... A lot of it's got to be as much anticipating as it is reacting.
Yeah. So I think we call it supervision. So you know, you have one-on-one supervision. So somebody helps you understand what you're doing and supports everything. And then you also, you know, provide training. And then you also provide training on how you deal with those things. So wellness kinds of things in terms of the special circumstances for all of our staff. You're dealing with, you know, a lot of situations and you hear things that are, you know, difficult to hear sometimes. So it really is a culture that you have to develop of, you know, a lot of it is called trauma that people have been through. So you try to, you know, minimize that for everybody and support the staff. And, you know, work as a team. I think having a team working with you, which is a little bit different for our agencies versus somebody who's in a private practice, right? So you're just doing it yourself. It's very different if you can depend on, you've got a psychiatrist here, a nurse practitioner, a nurse, a doctor, a counselor, a peer, you know, so that we work as a team to provide that kind of experience for the individuals that work for us, as well as the individuals that we serve in the communities.
We're talking with Cindy Volker, the president and CEO of Spectrum Health and Human Services, on What's Next. I want to say a typical case, but look, take me through a case, if you could. You said there's a team approach to things, but let's, you know, I'll let you pick out the, you know, whether it's an addiction service or a mental health service. Take us through how, first maybe how the person is identified or comes to Spectrum, and then take us through the hopeful process of getting somebody back, you know, on their feet, so to speak.
And, you know, I think I can do that from a kind of a personal perspective, because I've had family members and friends that'll call me, and I can think of one particular case and say, this is happening with my son, and, you know, and I don't know what to do, and there's all these symptoms, and, you know, and I'm right away going, okay, I know how it can be difficult to negotiate the system, right? Where do you go? How do you get help?
Right.
How can you be seen right away? So we have several places where you could walk in, which, of course, was at 1280, one of our biggest locations, where you could just walk in and get anybody to help you anytime you needed it. So, you know, you could get an appointment that day, have somebody see you, help you with the immediate needs. What's the immediate crisis? We could have you see a doctor or nurse practitioner that day if we needed to. Maybe you need to go to the hospital, which happened with this individual I'm thinking about. You got to work with CPAP, emergency room over at ECMC. Then they're evaluated and not admitted, and then you got to develop a comprehensive plan to keep them safe. Give them our crisis line, you know, make sure they've got some medications if they needed a safe place to go. So maybe you need, you know, the housing to help you with something depending on their circumstance. But, I think in this case, it's for me, I think about, you know, get the immediate help, get kind of a diagnosis of an idea of what's going on. What are the things we need to put in place to make this person safe and to be able to get to a point where we can start more treatment and then, you know, link up with the other services. So I think what you want is that you want immediate help when you need it, because what good does it do you if you have to wait, if you're really in a crisis? And then you want somebody assessing really what your needs are and then implementing that plan with you and your family or whoever is close to you that can help you. So
it's
it takes a lot to do that.
And
really,
usually more than one staff member is.
Yes.
Like we said,
yes,
a team approach.
And then, of course, a lot of people are challenged with maybe the individual doesn't really want the help, or maybe they're not sure they need the help, or they don't trust you. So, you know, you have to keep working at that and trying to, we always say, meet the person where they're at and just kind of figure out what's going to work with that.
That was Cindy Volker, the CEO of Spectrum Health. We'll now shift over to a conversation with celebrity chef Bobby Anderson. He sits down with guest host Saladin Allah to discuss the impact of his local youth workforce program, F-Bites, as well as his appearance on Hell's Kitchen, which led to him working for the famous chef Gordon Ramsay.
You talked a little bit about how you got the opportunity to be on season 4 of Hell's Kitchen. Now, did you have any experience being out in LA prior to that?
That rocked me. That rocked
what?
The world. You know, I'm from Niagara Falls. You know, I grew up in Niagara Falls, and I used to be the best chef in Buffalo, Niagara Falls. When I got there, it stripped me, Saladin. It scared me. And what I mean by it scared me, going to a different state, a different culture, a different brigade style of cooking really changed my whole entire trajectory about cooking. I am not the cook that you met 25 years ago. Even though I thought I was the best cook in Buffalo, I worked at all the fancy places as the chef, as the black chef, Marinaccio's, 5 years as the executive chef, Harry's on the waterfront, a sous chef for 4 years as the sous chef of the banquets, E.B. Green's, Chef de Parte. And people don't know what a chef de parte is. You run the whole E.B. Green's restaurant. That was a steakhouse. That was a four-star steakhouse as the chef. I did 7 years there. This is prior to Hell's Kitchen. So I had a bit of a chip when I left, Niagara Falls. But when I got to Los Angeles, California, when I got around Gordon, when I got around that European system, I got around those different type of high quality chefs over there. Not to say we wasn't high quality over here, but they're just they bred differently.
Mm.
And give you an example, it rocked my world. It changed my whole entire world. It knocked me down. And I think that's what Gordon had to do to me. You know, he had to strip me. He had to dominate my life. He came in my life and dominated it. And thank God it was Gordon, not the prison guard. Thank God it was Gordon, not the judge. Because thank God it was Gordon and not the drill sergeant. And that's what really changed my life. So, I can give you an example. Bobby, go in the cooler and get me 5 kilograms of Vermontan chocolate. Now, this is a turning point for me. You know, first of all, it's in kilograms. You know, we in pounds. So this is a turning point. I couldn't come back out that cooler without the chocolate. These are turning points for me. I can always remember that. And I went in there, and I came back out, and I kind of used my street smarts, you know, to convert the ounces to the kilograms. Did I tell him myself? I didn't tell him myself. All right, so, and he was like, wow, about time that you found your knack at something. So he made me the storeroom cook, you know. Wow. That's, you know, and those are the things, you know, that I had to learn really, really fast. And those were turning points for me inside of working with Gordon. But when he told me that I could participate in the American Dream, I wanted more of that. I wanted you to show me more of that. So he stripped me down and slowly started rebuilding me back up.
Wow.
And it was way much, much more than cooking. It was about honesty. You know, it was about being wrong. It was about believing in your own dream, you know, not telling your own self no. So he taught me much, much more than baking a souffle. It was really life changing.
Wow, man. And you sharing that, it makes me think about how that experience is universal, in a sense where I've had experiences where I've been totally out of my element. And I'm sure many other people could relate with that as well. But being in that situation or scenario, you also have to show up. And in some circumstances, you don't have no practice. You can't blame anybody. You have to be able to show and prove in that circumstance. And I think that hearing that part of your journey, I mean, people may have not been on a celebrity chef show and faced that type of challenge, but they've been in other situations where they've had to show up and they've had to meet certain challenges. And what helped you have the ability to face that situation? Because many people would have turned around and went back home. They wouldn't have had that confidence to go in there and to do what was necessary under those circumstances. Where did you pull something from in order for you to persevere in that circumstance?
Yes. So again, you know, Gordon, it takes a person to believe in you, to love you before you start loving yourself. You know, I think Gordon wrapped his arms around my career, my life at that particular, those 35 days. And he's always telling me, Bobby, you have to dig deep. And it took me to a place, I'm going to tell you how I persevered, Niagara Falls. I got to a place where you can't scare me with trouble. Niagara Falls was a training ground for me. You know, I started using my strengths and my wisdom and my awareness of how I grew up. You know, I grew up the only person that without a felon, you know, and I ran with felons. I never went to jail, and I went to go visit my buddies in jail. These are all survival skills that I had to maneuver. You know, the Niagara Falls, you know, again, it was a great practice ground, and I converted. I used those transferable skills inside of the kitchen. You know, how to get along with different type of people. And I was using DEI way before the buzzword. You know, it was a culture of people that, you know, especially the Italians, that you just had to get, you had to get along with. That's the way that it was. So I didn't look at the Kitchen Brigade as any differently. I knew the conversation. I knew the lingo. So again, you couldn't scare me with trouble from where I came from. So that was a real crucial, important part of my survival in Hell's Kitchen, because a lot of people do crack up. A lot of people can't handle that pressure. They're away from home. They're away from their friends. Mommy and daddy's not there. Their loved ones are not there. And a lot of people can't handle that. And for me, it changed my whole entire life. When I left Hell's Kitchen, I had a new walk. I had a new talk. I had a new dream. I can see it.
Wow. And then going through that experience and then returning back here to Western New York, how was that experience? And how did people engage you after seeing you on television and, you know, having this expectation of them knowing you prior to that?
Yeah, I had to get used to that, because I came home and I remember I used to wear the Hell's Kitchen jacket. I was like, don't you know me? You know, people were noticing me off the streets. I was running in 5K races. I was participating in different things, and people were recognizing me. And I never forget, I went to my old neighborhood and I went into a store, and I came out of the store, and the guy was like, hey, yo, you that Hell's Kitchen chef? He was like, well, check in. I thought he wanted an autograph or something. And, you know, so he said, check in. I was like, all right, you know, where's your pen? You know, because I was signing autographs at the time.
He might as well ask you what size shoes you wear.
Yeah, he said, check in, you know, Saudi. So I was like, all right, where's your pen? You know, I was that naive. Like, this is my home city. Ain't you happy for me? Ain't you? And this is a guy that I didn't know, you know. He just heard that I was this celebrity chef, and I had a new car at the time from my earnings from the show, and he tried robbing me, you know, and he got met with the same force that he brung it with. But nevertheless, to say that that took me on a journey, like, I got to do something else with this celebrity stuff other than some shiny car and going flaunting this Hell's Kitchen chef coat. And so, you know, at the time I was opening up several restaurants in the city of Buffalo. I was well sought after. I was doing appearances in New Jersey and New York City and San Francisco. And it just dawned on me, you know, when the guy told me to check in, I was like, I got to do something else. And so I said, you know, I started the F-Bites program. And I didn't know what that was. You know, I didn't know what that looked like. All I know is that, you know, I didn't want to, you know, take this newfound freedom and just keep it to myself or throw it away. And so that's where the whole F-Bites program came from being actually scared on the street, from being checked in. And it scared me to my purpose, you know. And I think that's where it all started. I started losing interest in opening up restaurants. I started losing interest in being in the limelight. I started taking interest in going and volunteering into different community centers and different shelters and different missions. I was just, you know, I just felt a different type of interest with my newfound fame.
Wow. And I wanted to give a shout out to one of our museum ambassadors at the Niagara Falls Underground Railroad Heritage Center, Navaya Everett. And Navaya was one of your past students in your F-Bites program. And with the support of her family, she was introduced to the culinary arts. She graduated from Niagara Falls High School 2024. And now she's enrolled at the Culinary Institute, following that path. And that is a direct impact. And she's just one person that I'm sharing. There's many other youth within the city of Niagara Falls, as well as the city of Buffalo and the surrounding areas, who have been impacted by the important work that you're doing.
Very important work, because not only that, we provide culinary skills, we provide life skills, soft skills. There's 300 graduates that have went through the program that we keep tabs on, has career paths in police officers, judges, lawyers, master social workers. And that's the story that I probably don't want to tell because it tears me up a little bit. But not only that, we're teaching them to be culinary readiness. That is just a vehicle while they're figuring life out. I guess I do got to tell this story about the MSW that she was 15 coming through my program. And this was 10 years ago. And she got pregnant. We met her where life is at. You know, we kept her working. We kept her employed. She was working at Olive Garden, and she finished high school, and she had this beautiful baby unexpectedly. But then she enrolled at the culinary institution, and she enrolled at CC, and she liked it that so much. You know, we just kept our hands on our arms on her. We chaperoned her to different places where she needed to go fill out applications. That's a big barrier in Niagara Falls, you know, transportation. So we were chaperoning her. And the next thing you know, she got inspired to become a MSW. So she enrolled in UB and got accepted at UB, and she graduated with this MSW degree. And now she contacted me out the blue about 2 months ago. She said she got her L. She's a licensed master social worker, and I got pregnant at 15. That's what F-Bites does. We don't trigger the trauma. We meet you where you at. Wow. If you want to wear your hat sideways at my cash register, as long as you're looking someone in the eye and firm handshake and got your pants pulled up, you can wear your hat sideways.
Wow.
That's it. So that's the work that we do over the last 15 years. You know, we've been doing it quietly because we're not at those mingles, or we're not at different places, and you know, we're not just out in the, you know, doing different things, and we're not asking for donations all the time. You know, our Starbucks, our restaurants are subsidiaries of the nonprofit. So, you know, we're you know, as a couple years ago before COVID, we're self-sufficient. We declined it outside contributions. We didn't need outside contributions. But after the COVID, that changed everything. But that's what the work does. The work really tells the metrics of your organization. You know, we were self-sufficient. You know, we didn't need any outside help, but you know, that changed. But yes, that's what F-Bites does. We meet these kids. We have different avenues of curriculums too. You're talking reentry program. We go inside the jails. Hardcore. We talked about those soft skills. All right, here's these hard skills. So if you're getting released, we hire you. We hired 45 over the last 8 years of doing our program at the Niagara County Jail. We went through a cohort over 45 reentry, and we hired over 15 individuals that was coming out of jail, and we paid them for that day. We paid them a stipend for that day. So those are the things that people don't see, that what F-Bites does, you know.
Wow.
Uniforms, non-slip shoes, you know, we support all that. We chaperone you to the culinary college. So I hate to go on a rant, but sometimes people don't know what the organization's doing when they don't see them next to Say Yes or you know, Matt Urban's or the Urban Leagues. You know, we're doing the work.
That was Bobby Anderson, the founder of F-Bites. We'll close out today's show with a trip the What's Next crew took to 321 Humboldt Parkway, the site of the late Robert Tranum Coles' historic studio. At the studio, Jay Moran sits down with Albert Chow, an architect looking to revitalize the site through the Coles House project.
We're remote today at 321 Humboldt Parkway. Talking about the Coles House project, we've already talked a little bit about Robert Tranum Coles, and most certainly would be worthwhile to maybe circle back to him to a certain extent. But we're with Albert Chow, who is among those trying to lead their way into this Coles House project. And one of the things, as I was looking into this a little bit, I mean, some of your background and some of the topics that were coming up, spatial justice is a term that I came across, which I just intrigued me to a certain extent. Tell me what you can about spatial justice.
So spatial justice, and
I'm going to also throw out design justice. So spatial justice is, you know, the impacts that physical space can have on us. So the most obvious one is the highway, for example, here. But it can also be access to goods, access to amenities, access to grocery stores, for example. So spatial justice is not just this, you know, huge gash in here, but can be larger systemic things. Why do we not invest in particular areas, for example? Or why do we see only a particular type of investment in particular areas? Design justice, I think, tries to think, understand this, and then reimagine or imagine possible futures, potentials, possibilities. And for me, design justice, you know, centers people within neighborhoods and the community that is there. And so in that imagination, you know, we can build together for a better community, but then also like it affects the city completely as well. And so we're trying to think through how we can model these processes.
When you look around the city of Buffalo or anywhere in Western New York, we throw that term out there, spatial justice. You do see things that it's egregious. How did this ever come about? I mean, we keep on talking about the highway and what is now the Skajakoda Expressway, where it intersects with the Kensington Expressway, and that's where we're located right now. But are there other things like, wow, here's something that when I first saw this, and the more I contemplated, like, this was just a total misnomer. It was you know, unjust in the way it's turned out. How about that?
Yeah, and a lot of this is built on historic injustices.
Sure.
So obvious ones are like redlining, infrastructure, attempts or veiled attempts, urban renewal plans, you know, and then trying to tackle that with other plans like, you know, Model Cities program. And the reason why I throw these out is because, you know, Buffalo was designed for, you know, millions. It was in its heyday, it had its moment. And yet, you know, with the eventual decline, it had its heyday. So you have these amazing structures, Guarantee Building, Martin House, all these different things. During its decline, you know, we don't have as many structures, but it's interesting. What do we study? We do study the Guarantee Building, architecture, Martin House, but Cole's built extensively, in the 60s and on. And so it's like, these are also buildings that we can study, not only for its architectural significance, but also for, you know, how do you build within, like, at that time, limited means? How do you reimagine these spaces? And so you can trace some of his projects in attempts to reimagine, you know, a community center, to imagine like a health center. The Jesse Nash Health Center, I've learned through research and through teaching, working with students, them teaching me that it was a Model Cities program building where they were trying to bring together disparate health services into one building, which is why when you look at it, you see four different forms coming together. So he's trying to architecturalize that as well.
It's interesting. Yeah.
I might have meandered a little.
No, that's good. Well, it does bring up Robert Trainham Coles, though. I mean, and it's worth exploring. It's, you know, it's interesting to hear your journey as, you know, an architecture student at the University of Buffalo, you know, here for 10 years, you leave, you come back, and that's when you heard about Robert Trainham Coles.
Yeah.
And just to hear you kind of talk about the Nash Clinic, Latin Nash Center, that you're seeing these I guess I'll call them subtleties, maybe from your perspective, someone who studies architecture, they're not all that subtle at all. I mean, what else do you see in his work?
Yeah, so if you kind of trace, I see a formalist.
Okay.
So you look at this house, it's two blocks, right? And there's a hyphen that connects the two. Some of his other projects are, you know, very formal, but as he's developed, you know, the Meriwether Library is probably one thing that he envisioned it as, you know, a series of villages. He went to Africa and considered the villages and how people meandered through them. And so the resultant form is still very formal, but it creates a different sort of communal space within it. And I've talked to the librarian there, the branch manager. He's amazing. But he talks about how the space is used. It gets, I think, an average, I don't recall all the numbers, but I think it gets an average, you know, book, people taking out books. But the foot traffic is unparalleled to any of the other libraries except for the central one.
Wow.
And so it just goes to show how much that is actually being used and how much that is being... I've been there where, you know, the hallways are just filled.
Sure, me too.
So, which is pretty amazing when you think about all the different structures. What I would love eventually is to, you know, and we have sort of done this, is to take a tour of all his different buildings, go and see how it's transformed, his style has transformed over you know, the decades he's practiced. And what's interesting to me is that, again, you know, I'm not the first person to do this. There was a gentleman here that we had invited for an open house, and he was kind of smiling, but he was like, you know, I led a tour centered around Cole's projects in Buffalo, and you know, other people have imagined these things
right.
too. And so hopefully we can kind of continue that energy.
And you see that growth? You see growth in his work as you maybe have gone through these different structures?
Yeah, I probably am thinking too much about them.
That's all right.
But I see the growth. I also see some of the limitations.
Limitations what, because of the resources available? Or?
The resources available, but he made, you know, he made them work in the capacity he could. And I think these are all stories I've been told by others. You know, he was challenged by, you know, budgets. These are, many of them are public buildings. Many of them have limited budgets. So, you know, you don't see more of the flash, but I think in his own way, there was a subtle movements that are pretty great. For example, you walk along the street, you see a brick wall,
mm-hmm.
and that's you. But then once you enter the house, it opens up. The glass is very intentional in bringing you to the backyard. And so when you look at some of these other buildings, it's not, you know, you look at the outside and they're a little bit more blank. You know, they're a little bit more austere, but when you walk in, they open up. The Meriwether Library is probably one of the best versions of this. Like, the skylights are pretty fantastic. So that's what I've been trying to learn and also learn with students. I bring students into these projects so that, you know, we can learn together. It's a collective project, so.
It's nice to talk about them, though, because, like you said, I mean, as an architecture student, not all necessarily familiar with his work. His work stands the test of time? I mean, that's a simple statement, but yeah.
Maybe this would be a segue into another. Standing the test of time also requires maintenance.
Right, right.
And care and an understanding. So there's a larger project happening now, National Trust for Historic Preservation with the Getty Foundation, Conserving Black Modernism. They have a grant out. And an oversimplification is that many of these buildings are either torn down or bought by developers or, you know, for lack of maintenance, unable to upkeep. And so they have set aside funding for this. And so this is the second year. Last year was the second year they launched this program. And eight projects got awarded nationally. Two of the projects are in Buffalo, and two of them are Kohl's projects. And so one of them is this house, and the other one is the JFK Recreation Center.
Wow.
And so, you know, getting to be able to keep these buildings open, you have to maintain them. And those, that, you know, how do we, and develop a plan. It's not only, you know, dusting off the roof, but it's also like, how do we envision these spaces being used? What are the potentials to, you know, to add to these buildings, to uplift some of the services that are already there. So, you know, standing the test of time requires more than just like being amazing.
Being brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, and you are a living example of it. I mean, you live inside this house at 321 Humboldt Parkway. It's got a flat roof, and you kind of blew it up. You're like, oh, you got to dust the roof. But you have to, you're maintaining this roof, a flat roof.
Yeah.
Here in the winter in Buffalo.
Yeah, so I don't go on the roof in the winter. I, you know, I think insurance would be, but, you know, clearing the gutters. There was a leak. Talking to the roofer to fix, you know, whatever was there, the different options. Nerding out about, you know, roofing details. Bitumen roof versus liquid applied roofing membrane. That's for the architecture nerds. And so it is about care. And then another thing is like, not only of the house, but the landscape as well. This is there's snow right now, but this is actually a pebbled garden walkway, which also requires a tremendous amount of weeding.
Oh, really?
And so
I'll mark that off as something I'm not going to do in my house, but sorry.
Yeah. Maybe a small section.
Yeah, maybe.
But, you know, as we think about the future of the house, how do we think about care, not only of the house, of the landscape, as a starter? And I think that can be emblematic of how do we think about care in a more general sense in the community. In architectural practice, how do we support a next generation of architects that can engage in these issues that are, you know, are coming up again? So, yeah.
And just one other feature, I mentioned the roof here at 321, but the basement is very different as well.
Yeah.
Because it leaves a really unique feature in the backyard.
Yeah, so this is a prefab house. One of the elements, you know, back in the day, this, I think one of the first models was like $10,000 for a house, which I found out is actually maybe close to $300,000. So it's still, if we can make it more affordable. But so it's only half sunken in so that you don't have to invest in, you know, a full foundation for a basement. But what it allows is that in the back over here, you have terrace steps. And what is kind of, I think, kind of amazing, so Omar Khan and Laura Garofalo were, you know, the first stewards after Kohl's. There, if you look at the steps, it used to be steps all the way across. It was Omar and Laura who introduced, how about we have seating in the middle. And, you know, this was when Coles was still here with us. And Coles was like, oh, great. And so you actually see, you know, you take for granted, this is a small design detail, but like these are the sensitive design details that I think hopefully we can continue on when we're doing our strategic rethinking of the house. The Conserving Black Modernism grant will help us in that process.
What's Next is over on Humboldt Parkway today. This is so exciting to go out on these remote adventures. We're at 321 Humboldt Parkway. It is the former home and studio of architect Robert Trainum Coles. And with us, Albert Chow, who is leading the Coles House project. I kind of led into it, and I saw you get all excited about inviting our listeners over to see this space, which is it's a wonderful space for sure. So let's get into that part of this project, that community engagement project, trying to make this space not so much a museum, but an active living space.
Yeah. So we've hosted multiple events. So again, I've been here since 2020. This was actually a safe haven during the pandemic. You know, professors would be in the back area gathering. And because it was open air and it was, we could socially distance. And I think there's a history of people already gathering here. This space just kind of engenders that sort of atmosphere. But what we're hoping and what we've been doing is holding open houses. The community can come in to see the before and hopefully the after. We have had an exhibition / architecture studio that I taught last spring at University of Buffalo. And so there were, you know, students here, but architects, practitioners who looked at the work, gave feedback, critiques. There was many reviewers, four of which had worked for Coles.
Oh. So
making a space to bring back the gang together and to like really think about, you know, and trade stories, talk about, you know, what I was here and someone was like, my desk was right there. And I was like, oh, wait, what? Like, can you tell me? And then somebody else was like, I think I built this part of the model. Like, did you build this part of the model? Like, so to have that history, to bring that back and to create that energy here. So that's part of it. And the open houses are open to everyone, and especially, you know, we want to bring in, you know, our neighbors, Hammond Park, first, and then, or not first, but like, you know, as part of this reaching out. And we are also hoping for some exhibitions we have planned that think about, you know, black homes, for example. We have exhibitions that are in the works that can kind of illuminate not only, you know, some of the issues that we're facing, but like imaginations of like what people are doing. I'm excited to have some of those, maybe some workshops for discussions and more gatherings here.
You mentioned the exhibition about black homes, and that most certainly intrigued me. So I mean, maybe kind of like in the developing stages or embryonic stages of it, but what can you tell me about that at this stage?
We are organizing with... It's still in the developing stages.
But, sure.
You know, how do we think about architecture not with a capital A? This is a unique house, right? But homes that have been, you know, are places for organizing, are places of welcoming, are places of resilience and resistance. So hopefully in August/September, we'll have more details about that. But, you know, it is a bit of organizing to bring this all together.
So the concept is still being built to a certain extent.
Still being designed. Might be even better than way of describing it.
It's actually designed. Well, no, it's not designed yet. We have a former employee of Mr. Cole's, Charles Davis. He teaches at UT Austin.
Oh, okay.
He also was born and raised in Buffalo. And he used to teach at Buffalo as well. And he had an exhibition, Black Homes as Public Art. And so our ambition is to bring that exhibition here, transform it to this particular space, because it's very different than a gallery space. And so what, like, what this kind of helps do is to not only look again at the past, but then reimagine what this space is, you know, as one of the homes as part of this.
Yeah.
There's multiple layers to this, which is exciting.
Sure, absolutely. And we're just kind of, peeling back a few of those layers as we speak. So, and again, the idea of the public being invited, how can the public stay attached in some way? Is there a way to do that here?
We have a website.
Okay.
We have social media, Instagram. We have a Facebook and LinkedIn page. We'll blast it out, and we're hoping to blast them out soon. So
Cole's House Project, what is that? What you'd be looking for online?
Yeah, coleshouseproject.org.
Right, so. right. Wow, I'll tell you what, it's an exciting concept. I guess we probably already know it, but I mean, Cole's would probably be pretty pleased to know that his space is centering and maybe leading to some connections with a community that sometimes is overlooked and not given its credence.
Yeah, I'm talking to multiple people. You know, he did have visions of, he was always engaged, and especially in the architecture and design world and also in the community. But I think he, there were people that, I've never met him, so they had told me that, you know, he had thought about the space as a community space, or transforming it into a community space. I'm not sure this would be the exact version, but you know, we're learning and we're growing. So.
And you're having a talk show right in the middle of the space. So, you know, again, you know, it's finding its all new ways, and it's adapting as it goes along. I kind of touched about this a little bit more, but maybe we can kind of finish up our conversation. Not just of the Cole's House Project, maybe being, if not the center, but most certainly a part of a spirited energy here in the city. I always like to ask people if they're, how hopeful they are. And I think, you know, since you're living here and you're pushing this, you're hopeful. But what about that? I mean, the hope for what this community can become. What do you see? What do you think?
Yeah, hopeful. Multiple answers to this, probably. You know, when I bring people in, students, neighbors, you just see them light up. And so there is like, and then you see people start talking about the space and eventually about the neighborhood and their own porches and their own, you know, houses that they have been investing in for so much time. So there's that aspect of it. And I think, looking to particular building communities. So architecture, design, students, specifically bringing them here to think about how they can practice, they can be architects, they can be designers. Who are they working with/for? So I think these are new imaginations that I'm hopeful that this house can carry that sort of spirit.
And that will do it for this edition of Producer Picks of the Week. We thank our guests, Cindy Volker, Bobby Anderson, and Albert Chow. If you missed anything, or just want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts, including the full individual episodes aired in today's compilation. Each episode is online at WBFO.org. I'm Michael Loss. Thank you for tuning in.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.